From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a hidden drug problem. Drugs that are cheap, accessible, legal, and very dangerous. We'll talk about inhalant abuse, getting high on substances like glue, gasoline, and many aerosol products. Also today, Spinal Tap is gearing up for a reunion tour to once again lampoon the world of heavy metal. We'll talk with band member Harry Shearer about Spinal Tap and about the voices he does on The Simpsons. And book critic John Leonard reviews Richard Klerman's account of the Time Warner merger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. British Prime Minister John Major held talks today with the leaders of the four main political parties in Northern Ireland. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Major called the meeting last week, alarmed by the scale and the intensity of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland since the new year began. 27 people, nearly all civilians, have been killed. Today's talks produced little of substance, though Major said the two sides had agreed to meet again.
The party leaders this afternoon all expressed the hope that by continuing to work together and by making representations together on matters of common concern, they would contribute to the growth of mutual trust and confidence within the community in Northern Ireland. We all believe that that would eventually aid the talks process.
The agreement falls short of reopening the political dialogue between Protestants and Catholics that was abandoned in July, but it does represent a step in that direction. The government had previously indicated that further talks were unlikely before the British general election later this year. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
The Pakistani government said today that its troops have managed to push back several groups of Muslim militants who are trying to cross from Pakistan into the Indian-controlled area of Kashmir. Muslim leaders have appealed for a mass march of unarmed demonstrators to cross the border to protest India's hold on the predominantly Muslim area. Today, Pakistani troops used tear gas to hold off five groups of militants, ranging in size from about 100 to 1,500 people. There were no injuries reported among the militants, and Indian and Pakistani troops held their gunfire on both sides of the border. About 7,000 more demonstrators are said to be on their way to the border, saying that they will cross or die. The Red Cross announced today that it's making available documents from Nazi Germany that may help hundreds of thousands of people find out the fate of their relatives. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The documents, among them death books from labor and concentration camps, were collected by American forces and used in the Nuremberg war trials. Since then, they've been sitting in a Maryland warehouse, viewed by researchers and historians, but unavailable to the general public. The Red Cross is in the process of microfilming the documents and sending them to Germany. There, they will be used to trace missing persons for family members, such as Margaret Lipton, who was separated from her parents in 1939 and never knew exactly what happened to them.
They gave me exact their dates and where they were sent and which camp they were sent to the gas chamber. They were together until to the end.
The Red Cross says the documents may contain as many as 500,000 names. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to close at 3,251.57. Advances led declines by a margin of about 9-7 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Security forces in Algeria continued their crackdown on Muslim fundamentalists today, arresting four Islamic guerrillas and sentencing more than 150 others. Algerian radio reported that police found a cache of weapons at a mosque in a town east of Algiers, where two police officers were killed yesterday by Muslim extremists. German government officials have rejected Russia's demands for more money to help finance troop withdrawals from the eastern part of Germany. Deirdre Berger reports.
In return for Soviet approval of German unification, the Bonn government in 1990 promised nearly $9 billion to help finance the pullout of the Soviet army from East Germany. Now, the Russian government says it wants nearly $7 billion more in payment for the troop bases it is leaving behind. But Bonn Defense Minister Gerhard Stoltenberg says the Russians are demanding unrealistic prices for their bases, given the high degree of environmental damage. Most of the money promised by the Bonn government for troop withdrawal is intended for new housing for returning soldiers. The Russian government and several other Commonwealth countries dispute the location of the projected housing. The Bonn government says it is freezing funds for construction until the former Soviet countries can agree where the housing is to be erected. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The European Parliament voted today to recommend that all tobacco advertising be banned in the 12 countries of the European Community as of the 1st of next year. The measure would eliminate tobacco ads on radio and television, newspapers, and billboards. It would also prohibit tobacco companies from sponsoring sporting events, even if cigarette brand names aren't displayed on the athletes' uniforms or on racing cars. The proposal passed on a narrow vote of 150 to 123 with 12 abstentions. It must be passed a second time before it's sent on to the EC Council of Ministers for final approval. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe you've been reading occasional newspaper stories about teenagers who died after getting high by inhaling fabric protector or gasoline fumes. There's a frightening trend behind those stories. Some of the products under your sink can be used for a cheap, legal, but very dangerous high, a high that often results in permanent brain damage. I remember stories about glue sniffing when I was growing up. I had thought that was over, when in fact inhalant abuse has really branched out into butane, spray paint, many aerosols, and even markers and correction fluids. It's mostly children and young teenagers who use inhalants. In a few minutes, we'll find out the scope of the problem and why these chemical highs are so toxic. We'll talk with Marvin Snyder of the National Institute of Drug Abuse. But first, let's hear the story of a 15-year-old who was addicted to inhalants. The first time he tried it, he was 10, but it wasn't until he was 14 that he became a regular user. I spoke to him and his mother by phone. They live in a small western town. They preferred to not use their names, so I'll call them Jimmy and Kathy. Jimmy told me what inhalants he used to get high on.
About anything I could get my hands on. Paint, gas, Scotchgard, anything that, you know, would get me high.
What kind of high were you getting?
Hallucinogenic high most of the time. Those, you know, it enhanced your senses and loss of memory, and it just all depended on, you know, how long I sat there and got high.
How did you find out that these chemicals could make you high?
I can't remember. I was really young when I heard about it, you know, and I had tried it, you know, experimenting when I was around 10. But I never really liked it that much until I started doing other drugs. And it was just kind of a way to get high when, you know, when I was looking for other drugs and I couldn't get any. I just used them till I could get what I wanted.
How often would you do it?
It got to the point where I was doing it every day.
Did you have any hangover or side effects?
No, actually, it was just like I couldn't remember what happened when I was, you know, doing it sometimes. And when I try and think of things real fast, it'd take me a while to, you know, figure out what I was trying to think of later.
So you were having memory problems?
Yeah, I was having a hard time. It was just hard to think straight, you know, to keep my mind on anything.
What kind of hallucinations were you having?
I had a lot of, like, in my room. I remember one, for instance, I was in my room doing it at night, and I had this little light on, and I looked over on my by my dresser drawer, and there's an Indian standing there. And, you know, it was lifelike. I really thought it was there. And then I realized that it wasn't there. And then another day I was sitting out on my couch, and I was doing it, and I heard voices, you know. Somebody said, like, stop or something. And then I looked out the window, and I saw, you know, a bunch of people walking in my yard. And I went outside, and, you know, and there's nothing there. But I really thought it was real. I mean, it was just so intense.
Did you know that inhalants were dangerous?
Yeah.
What? How much did you know about that?
I didn't really. I mean, I knew it could cause brain damage, but I never really believed it because I never thought it was real dangerous. You know, because it just seemed like, you know, such a harmless high until, you know, I started blacking out and stuff, and then I realized that it was, you know, it was really dangerous.
When you say you didn't believe it, is that because you think a lot of the just say no campaigns and stuff like that are a lot of hype?
Yeah, I mean, you know, once you get into drugs, you don't really hear any of that. It's like, you know, it's just like a, you know, just a line or something. You don't consider it.
So how long did it take until you started blacking out?
It all depended on however long. I mean, just if I'd sit there for, you know, an hour or so doing that, I'd probably end up blacking out and just keep going whilst, you know, in a blackout.
How do you do that?
You just black out. You don't remember anything, but I mean, you're still doing things normal. You just can't remember it.
I see. Kathy, how did you find out that Jimmy was using inhalants?
It began fairly innocently. He would be working on his motorcycle, and I would go out into the garage to call him for dinner or something, and would smell kind of this overwhelming smell of gasoline. And I had worked in alcohol and drug rehab before in Atlanta, and so I knew. You had heard about inhalants, but really not that much. So I got this real sick feeling that maybe that's what was going on, and then I would notice his eyes were real dilated, and he was high. And at first you don't want to think that that's what they're doing, so you sort of, and I did, I made excuses for it. Oh, he's just been around that gas too long, and, you know, these kind of things. And it wasn't all the time. Maybe it was over a three-year period that I caught him maybe four times. So it's amazing what you can do when you decide to go into denial, and I did.
When did you decide that you really needed to talk with him?
Oh, we talked about it very seriously all the time. Every time I caught him, and he promised, "I'll never do it again." And I could tell he was genuine. He didn't want to do it again. And I think it would scare him, it would embarrass him. But he was doing it alone, and that concerned me. It wasn't like it was peer pressure. It was just something I finally realized that he was enjoying. And it wasn't until I saw him do it myself personally, 2 days in a week, right after I had gotten back from being out of town, that I realized he was being caught too much. In other words, I realized that he literally could not help it, and we had an addiction problem. Actually, my 18-year-old daughter is the one that pushed me into doing something. She said, "Mom, you've got an addict on your hands." And when you say the word addict, you don't think of addict and inhalant, but that is, in fact, what the term would be.
Jimmy, what was your reaction to your mother when she started catching you getting high?
I'd make stuff up, like, you know, I was bored, so I did it, or, you know, I didn't want to admit that I had a problem with it, you know, because I really told myself I didn't, you know, so I made myself believe that I was all right, but, you know, I had a problem.
What happened finally? You went into a rehabilitation program?
Mm-hmm.
So whose decision was that? Was it yours, Jimmy, or yours, Kathy?
It was my mother's.
Uh-huh.
And she, you know, one morning, the day before I went, she said, "Well, you're going to treatment tomorrow," and I just, you know, I thought, you know, why? I mean, you know, I got real mad, and I said, "Why?" You know, and she told me, you know, I had a problem, and I denied it and tried to talk my way out of it, but still went.
So, Jimmy, what was your reaction to the rehab program?
When I first got there, I was, you know, nervous because I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know what the program, you know, what it was for. I thought it was just kind of a way to get rid of your kid, you know, when you're having trouble. And I just felt, you know, alone, and I kind of felt like everybody was against me, you know, trying to just put me in trouble and just, you know, make me mad and stuff. And so I, you know, had a lot of anger towards my parents, and I didn't want to talk to them.
So most of the other people in the program were, like, coke addicts or junkies?
Just, you know, anything, you know, real drugs that, you know, they got a hold of.
So what was their reaction to your habit? I mean, did the people who were addicted to things like cocaine or heroin or even alcohol know anything about inhalants, and what were they really curious about what you had been doing?
Really, they thought it was, you know, they thought it was kind of a joke, you know, they didn't think it was, like, a big deal, you know, but then, you know, they started to understand in the group therapy, you know, what it was all about, that it was, you know, it was just like any other drug.
Is that a common thing that people kind of laugh and think it's a big joke?
Yeah, they think it's like a thing you do when you're a kid, you know, just messing around, you know, kind of do some glue and get high, and then, you know, never think about it again.
Kathy, do you find that to be true, too, that people laugh at inhalants?
Yeah, I don't think that they take the problem seriously, and I think the reason is because they're ignorant about the problem. There just hasn't been a lot of education that's getting out there to the public. One of the things that we found and that we learned about inhalants was that there is a lot of ignorance where it's concerned. In the treatment center, Jimmy was called a huffer. That's the street term for someone that inhales substances. And it's sort of the bottom of the barrel in the drug culture world. Because the kids don't really consider it a drug. And so it's one of the ways they can kid themselves into thinking, well, I don't really use drugs. You know, I sniff a little this, sniff a little that. So that's one of the problems that I see, is that there's just simply not an awareness of the fact that this does go on, number one, and that it is so deadly dangerous. It's one of the hardest addictions, according to these counselors we were with, to kick, because it's so easily accessible and because there's no middleman. When you're going to buy booze or buy drugs, you have to have money, and then you have to make a conscious decision to go and contact a third party to get the substance. With this, it's right under your kitchen sink, and you can go for it.
Are there certain household products or aerosols that you're afraid to keep around the house now?
No, I'm really not. Once an addict decides to go straight, it's their decision. I can't play police lady. If I did, I wouldn't have a house with anything in it. We'd have nothing, no cleaning products or anything. So there has to come a point when you trust the addict, and the addict decides that it was dangerous and it's over. And he works a 12-step program. This is what was in the treatment center. They work a 12-step program like any addict or alcoholic would. So if he decided tomorrow that he wanted to go get high and sniff some gas, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do to keep him from doing it. He has to be the one that decides that is not the way of life he chooses, and he has. And so we don't watch anything that's in our house.
Kathy, is there anything you wish you knew, a few years ago when
I wish
started?
I knew that one bad trip, I'm sure everyone's system is different. I wish I had known that one inhaling experience could kill a child or cause permanent neurological damage. We were lucky. We are so lucky. And I really did not know that, because I was in denial. I didn't want to think it was as bad as it was, but it was just an ignorance of this sort of substance abuse. So I wish I had known that. And I also wish that there had been more education in the schools. There really was not, and the kids aren't really aware of it either.
Well, Jimmy, let me ask you, if there had been education in the schools, do you think that would just help educate people that there's a cheap, available high under the kitchen sink?
In a way, yeah. Yeah, I think it would have.
So you think education would be a kind of mixed blessing here?
For me, I know it would have. It wouldn't have helped me. It would have just been kind of like a joke, you know, something to make fun of.
Are there certain signs that you think parents should look for to see if their kids are doing inhalants?
You know what, one of the big things is your nose. Smell. I would find these overwhelming smells of gasoline and paint. And I was so just out of it, I guess. I didn't understand that was a sign. But your nose is an incredibly valuable tool to start with. And then there'll be other things. You'll notice their equilibrium will get off. And I noticed the memory loss. Sometimes in teenagers, that's kind of hard to tell the difference in. But the memory loss would intensify. And his eyes would get real red and dilated. Speech would be slurred. But the big thing for me was the smell. And finding little things like empty bags with paint that he had put in them and had used them. And then I'd find them in the trash can.
Jimmy and his mother, Kathy, preferred to not use their real names for the interview. We'll talk about inhalants with a science policy expert from the National Institute of Drug Abuse after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We certainly hear a lot more about crack and heroin than inhalants. So to get a sense of how widespread inhalant abuse is and why it's such a dangerous high, we called Marvin Snyder at the National Institute for Drug Abuse. He directs the Office of Science Policy, Education, and Legislation. I asked him how inhalants fit into the larger pattern of drug abuse in America.
Inhalants actually represent a somewhat different type of problem that we normally face with drugs like heroin or cocaine or PCP. Most inhalants are available. That is, they're not really controlled the way we controlled other drugs, and there's very easy access to inhalants. As a matter of fact, one way of looking at inhalants is that you could look at it as a model for what might happen or what could happen in this country if drugs were made legally available. And in this case, you see that you have a particular problem in very young children because of the low cost and easy availability. The problem with inhalants is that they are a particularly dangerous form of drug abuse, one which has proven to be very difficult to treat, and unfortunately one which hits, to a large extent, low socioeconomic groups. And the last point on this score is that over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been a slow but steady increase in the numbers of people who seem to be involved with inhalant abuse, mostly young children. That has moderated a little bit in the last few years, but the overall long-term trends are not very, very encouraging.
I want to ask you about the types of products that are being abused, but before I do, I want to ask you if this is a question that's problematic to answer. I mean, education on a subject like this must be problematic because you don't want to be educating people how to become abusers, which inhalants to get high from, and how to do it. On the other hand, you probably want to alert people to the dangers of inhalants. So what's your opinions on what kind of information should be disseminated?
Well, I think many, unfortunately, in today's society, many kids who are at risk from inhalant abuse really, by one way or another, know about the fact that you can get high on certain types of products. The prevention programs that one might anticipate doing with inhalants would largely be focused on the problem areas. That is, I wouldn't think that we would do a national program because, for just the same reason you mentioned, that there may be a little too much education than one would want. But on the same hand, if you went into communities where there was a large inhalant problem, the chances that you were telling the kids anything they didn't know would be rather small, even negligible.
So what you'd want to tell them is about the dangers, which they might not know about.
You'd want to talk about the dangers, about the problems that follow in the sense of trying to indicate to kids, which proves to be very difficult to do, that if you use these drugs today, it may affect your ability to develop into a fully functioning adult many years down the pike. Most kids think that they're invulnerable to the effects of drugs and that they're never going to die, their brains aren't going to be affected by these things in the long run, and that turns out to be untrue with regard to inhalants in particular.
What are you risking if you inhale these chemicals?
You're risking organic damage to a variety of body systems, including your liver, your kidneys, your heart, and your brain in particular. Even there's some reports of visual loss. In other words, these are many, many different chemicals. It's not just the toxicology of one chemical.
Mm-hmm.
And there's possibly brain damage. There's possibly loss of balance from a different part of the brain called the cerebellum. There's possibly peripheral neuropathy. There's some loss of movement in your hands, for example, control of your hands. Some reports of Parkinson-like symptoms. Some reports of visual loss. And other than that, that's a textbook chamber of horrors, as it were, of what can happen to somebody who's abusing different types of solvents. The problem, of course, is that when you breathe in something that's in a can in the store, and you know we're attributing a lot of these problems to the solvents, we don't even know that to be true. In point of fact, it may be due to the solvents or the propellants in the can, and plus the material in the can, which you know there are degreasers and detergents. And a whole variety of other compounds in there, and it's that complex that can prove to be so difficult to really pin down as saying, what is it in this can that's causing this damage? What we're saying is that people who do this behavior suffer from these problems, and we think a large part of the problem is due to the compounds in there, the inhalable compounds, but it could be the entire can.
You said before that inhalant abuse is difficult to treat. What makes it more difficult than any other kind of drug abuse?
Well, first of all, to a large extent, inhalant abusers tend to be young children, at least in the beginning. And it's very difficult to treat youngsters for drug abuse in the first place because they don't have anything to fall back on. To a large extent, they've gotten involved in drug abuse because their lives in general don't seem to have been working out for them. There's a tendency for broken homes in the background of inhaled abuse is a tendency for low socioeconomic status. And these kids have limited resources available to them. The other problem with inhalants is that we do not at the present time, because of the varied nature of inhalants and the real lack of understanding about how they actually are working, there are no real medications to assist in treatment.
The way the United States has dealt with addiction has been to make drugs illegal, with the exception of alcohol.
And cigarettes.
Yeah, and cigarettes. So what direction would you like to see policy take on inhalants? I mean, let's face it, these are common household products, and the products work. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, this is a common problem, one that there, in point of fact, it's very difficult to determine what policy we could follow in the sense of it wouldn't make sense to do a policy concerning illegality of these compounds. If it would have been done already, I assure you. I think that what we have to do with inhalants at this point, and we are actually, let me back up and point out that over the past 10 years, basically, we have, the national government, and including the Institute, which I'm a member of, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has focused largely on cocaine and heroin addiction. And this is because of the relatively large numbers of people that were involved in it, because of the drug trafficking, and maybe most importantly, because of the link of those compounds to HIV infection, that is AIDS. Over the last several months, this problem, a number of other problems, which have always been there, are getting more attention from us, and this includes both inhalants and hallucinogens, including LSD. And we intend to increase our activities involving inhalants. And in effect, that's what the policy is going to be, that is to increase the amount of research that goes in to prevention and treatment of inhalant abuse and try to increase, although we don't have primary responsibility for this, the resources available for the treatment of inhalant abuses.
What kind of cooperation are you getting or would you like to get from the industry that manufactures the products that are inhaled?
Well, one thing we would like to get is more warning labels, and I think the industry has been of late responding a little bit more positively in this direction, although that's not an area that I'm particularly familiar with. I know there has been some movement. The other issue would be whether or not they could look at other forms of propellants. That is, some of the items that are commonly abused are actually the propellants in the cans. That is, it's what forces the material out of the can, and not only is it something that may be dangerous to the individual who's abusing it, but also dangerous to the environment as a whole. And so in those few cases where different types of propellants could be used, such as compressed air or some other non-abusable compound, we would hope that they would look for that. That's not going to be possible for all activities, and in point of fact, it's, as you said, these are common chemicals found everywhere and, in point of fact, necessary for, in some ways, for a modern society. And it's difficult to see how you could control them.
Marvin Snyder directs the Office of Science Policy, Education, and Legislation at the National Institute of Drug Abuse. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Harry Shearer is a satirist and actor, a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, and the host of a weekly public radio show. He does a lot of the voices on The Simpsons. He's also a member of possibly the most popular heavy metal band that never existed, Spinal Tap. Now the band created for the rock documentary spoof This is Spinal Tap is coming out with a new album, and they're heading out on tour. Coming up, we talk with Harry Shearer. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews To the End of Time. It's an account of the merger between Time Magazine and Warner Communications, and it was written by former Time executive Richard Clurman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Bush administration says it will accelerate the phase-out of ozone-depleting chemicals and is calling on other nations to join the effort. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a statement released at the White House late today, the administration announced it will phase out the production of CFCs and most other ozone-depleting chemicals 5 years ahead of current international deadlines. The president will also ask U.S. producers of CFCs to reduce production to 50% of their 1986 levels by the end of the year. In the statement, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater cited recent studies showing that CFCs are depleting the ozone layer over the Northern Hemisphere far quicker than originally thought. The president also called on nations that have not joined the international agreements on protecting the ozone to follow the U.S. lead in accelerating the phase-out of CFCs and other harmful chemicals. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Yugoslavia officials in Croatia say that they will turn down any new proposals set forth by the UN to implement a peace plan. According to Croatian officials, recommendations by the UN Secretary General last week contradict a plan already presented by diplomat Cyrus Vance. Under Vance's plan, the Federal Army would pull out of Serbian-held regions and 10,000 peacekeeping troops would be sent in. Croatian officials say that the UN Secretary General is proposing ideas that would mean a loss of control of one-third of their land now held by Serbian factions. In the meantime, four people have been killed in clashes in eastern Croatia. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to block the repatriation of some 11,000 Haitian boat people from the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. But the High Court also requested the Department of Justice to respond by Friday to charges by human rights groups that it suppressed statements by some refugees that they face political persecution. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Human rights groups opposing the repatriation of Haitian refugees claimed the Bush administration misled the Supreme Court. They said the administration covered up statements by some refugees that they face political persecution in Haiti. The statements were made by at least 42 Haitians who were forced to return home and fled a second time. They have been granted entry into the United States to pursue political asylum. They told the United Nations they had suffered imprisonment and torture by Haiti's 5-month-old military regime when they returned home. The State Department said that diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Haiti checked out four of the claims and found nothing. The Bush administration maintains refugees from Haiti are fleeing economic conditions, not political repression. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 6 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Police found a bomb this morning near the British Foreign Office in London, 5 hours before Vice President Quayle was slated to visit. Telephone warnings had led to the evacuation of Parliament Square and nearby government buildings in downtown London. Police believe the bomb was planted by the Irish Republican Army, making it the second time in a month that the IRA had managed to get near a government building. Recently, the IRA has engaged in a stepped-up bombing campaign in Northern Ireland and Britain. Boxer Mike Tyson is being treated like any other convicted felon today in courts in Indiana. Last night, Tyson was found guilty of raping an 18-year-old contestant in last summer's Miss Black America pageant. Lorna Jordan from member station WVXU reports.
Tyson will go through the normal pre-sentencing process. This morning, he reported to the Indiana court for an interview and to begin a background check. A report will be compiled on the former heavyweight boxing champion, and it will be presented to the judge before sentence is passed March 6th. Lawyers for Tyson will prepare their own version of the pre-sentencing report. The judge will consider both when making a decision on how much time, if any, Tyson will serve. At that sentencing hearing in March, the woman who brought the charges will also be able to tell the judge how much time she thinks Tyson should serve. He was convicted last night of raping a beauty pageant contestant. He could serve up to 60 years in prison, but it's likely to be closer to 6 years because it's his first offense as an adult. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Indianapolis.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says that he's willing to push interest rates even lower, though he believes the Fed has done enough to stimulate growth for now. Speaking today to a banking group in Texas, Greenspan said the Fed believes that interest rates have been cut enough and that patience now is needed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is the voice of Homer Simpson's boss and lots of other characters on The Simpsons, but you'll also recognize his voice from his political satire on All Things Considered. You probably also know Harry Shearer as a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. But what elevated him to cult status was his role in the rock documentary spoof This Is Spinal Tap. Shearer played the part of the band's bass player, Derek Smalls. The band Spinal Tap parodies heavy metal music, the self-indulgent musicians who play it, and the excesses of their stage shows. Real heavy metal music has been topping the record charts, and Spinal Tap is gearing up for a reunion tour. They have a new record coming out next month. I asked Harry Shearer how the members of Spinal Tap decided to reunite.
Really, what happened was that Christopher Guest and Michael McKean and I independently found ourselves at a Squeeze concert at the Universal Amphitheater. And I was walking around the periphery of the interior of the building waiting for the opening act to conclude and ran into him in the lobby. And we just started exchanging anecdotes about how, in the absence of any entrepreneurial or marketing push, this thing had just sort of grown as a phenomenon, as a cult phenomenon, as it's called, over the years. And we're just sort of musing, gee, you know, this thing is probably bigger than ever. We started asking people, you know, who are paid to know these things, and they said, yeah, there's probably something here. So we thought, well, let's see. It'd be fun to do it again.
You know, you've been on tour before with Spinal Tap, right?
Well, the only tour that Spinal Tap really did was a very short kind of mini tour, and we only played clubs. We played like 500-seat clubs because we really didn't have a big stage show, and we didn't want to look really stupid standing on a big stage with nothing except ourselves and our instruments. So this will be the first time we'll go into really big venues.
Like stadiums? You're going to do stadiums?
No. Terry, get hold of yourself.
I thought maybe you'd be opening for Aerosmith.
Calm down, girl. Well, there'll be a few big festivals that the Spinal Tap may play in England that'll be frighteningly large, but basically we're talking about like 5,000-seat kind of facilities.
So what kind of sets do you have now?
Sets. Well, they're being designed as we speak. And since the budgetary process is a very live component of that, I can't really tell you yet. It'll be grand. Grand and stupid.
What kind of sex have you been having?
Grand and stupid.
When you're a parody heavy metal band, do you have parodies of groupies hanging out backstage waiting for you?
Well, again, since we haven't done the real tour, we had what seemed like very real groupies the last time. I mean, the interesting thing about the whole project is that some of the people who are attracted to it get every nuance and know every wrinkle of what's supposed to be funny about it, and some people are there because they think it's at least borderline legitimate. And I think the same was true of the people that gathered backstage. The other thing that's interesting about groupiedom these days is apparently you really get what you ask for, because we have Spinal Tap has a song called Big Bottom. It's one of their more well-known songs. It's everybody plays basses, and it celebrates that particular piece of the anatomy. And that's the description of the women that showed up. So apparently in rock and roll these days, you know, you just put out the specs and they go, oh, that's what they want.
That's pretty strange, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So,
It's all too linear for me, Terry.
Well, seriously, though, how'd you react to all of this? Because after all, you're a parody of the real thing, but real people are coming up taking you seriously as groupies. So, what do you? I mean.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting experience because what it ends up being is we stay in character and deal with everything as these people. So it's really the most bizarre kind of acting experience because you're acting, you're totally into this other character, and you're interacting with other people who may or may not know what it is you're doing.
So how do you think the heavy metal scene has changed since you did the film? Things you're going to have to really catch up on before you're back on the road in this tour.
Wonderfully enough, this thing became ossified so early, this form, that you can come back after a deep sleep and not really find that you've missed all that much. You know, the stagecraft has advanced, obviously. The technology of putting a show on stage has improved, and the sound has gotten, you'll be glad to know, louder.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. So we recommend the double earplugs.
Right, right. So on to The Simpsons. I have to ask you about The Simpsons.
Yeah.
You're the voice of the assistant to Homer's boss.
I'm also the voice of his boss.
And also, whenever there's somebody really smarmy, you're them, too.
Yeah, it's kind of typecasting. I'm the school principal and the school bus driver and the local newscaster and the local preacher and virtually all the doctors they ever run into. I'm the black doctor and the white doctor.
Oh, whenever there's a radio show or a TV show.
Most of the time, yeah, that's me, too.
What's the process like? Are you in the studio with a lot of the other people doing voices, or do you all record your parts separately?
No, it's basically like an old radio show. We're all in a large room or in a semicircle with microphones in front of each of us, going scene by scene through the show. We do each scene several times, but that's the only way you get the kind of interplay among actors that I think sets it slightly apart from a lot of shows that are just people doing funny voices.
Now, the characters synced to your voices, or do you do it watching the characters?
No, the artists sync to our voices.
So you haven't seen the drawings when you're recording?
No. With a new character, we very often don't even know how he looks.
You've played a lot of smarmy people in the past few years, both in some of the parts you do in The Simpsons and in movies.
Well, thank you very much.
What is it about you that you're getting those parts?
I think they see the essential smarminess within, Terry.
Yeah, I was setting you up for that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I like to play, you know, if you like to do comedy, and especially sort of slightly edgy comedy, then the people that you think are funny are people who have something severely wrong with them in one way or another, and I guess that's who I get to play.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Shearer, one of the voices on The Simpsons. He's about to tour with Spinal Tap, and you, of course, also know him from his political commentaries, his political humor on National Public Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Harry Shearer is my guest. Who were some of the people on TV who made the biggest impression on you when you were growing up? The kinds of announcers or TV commercials or...
Not the comedy people?
No. I mean the kind of people who you're kind of parodying in a way.
Oh, well, the voices that I had in my head when I was growing up, these will be fairly obscure people, but bear with me. There was an announcer on the Jack Benny show, not Don Wilson, but there was a guy who did the Lucky Strike commercials from time to time and other commercials too, named Del Sharbat. I've actually run into his kid recently, and I'm probably the only one who said, "Hey, you're Del Sharbat's son." But he had one of these deep, deep voices like that, and that was the first time I heard a guy really pumping the cojones, as you might say. But a lot of the important sounding voices, you know, I was a little young for H.V. Kaltenborn, but I heard him sort of on nostalgia shows, and all those documentary voices and Ed Murrow, of course, and those were the voices that first really spoke to me. Was all the voices of portent and importance on radio and television, Huntley and Brinkley, Cronkite, those guys.
Did you know that you were capable of doing the voice? Because you certainly are. I mean, you do it with irony, but you really know how to get the voice.
Yeah. Well, I know how to be authoritative in totally non-authoritative purposes. When I was a kid, I would just do all those voices, and in my head, it sounded like I was hitting them right on the money. Although I'm sure to my parents, it all sounded like, you know, very indistinct variants of this basic voice. But the thing was, I was learning to make some sort of changes that satisfied me in my head, and that turned out to be, you know, the only clue you have later on. So I was learning to use the tool somehow.
So what was your first break into show business? You were a journalist first.
No, my first break into show business was when I was a child. I was 7 years old, and I got a job on the Jack Benny radio show. So I started kind of at the top, and I've been steadily working my way down ever since.
So who were you on Jack Benny?
I worked with him for 8 years, so from time to time I was either Jack Benny as a child, or I was a member of this group of kids that he sort of chaperoned around for various activities called the Beverly Hills Beavers.
Did you have a stage mom?
No, I had a regular mom. I had regular parents, very sane parents, which is the only thing you really need to have a good time as a child actor. And of course, it's almost impossible to have them. But it was a wonderful experience, and it is, you know, it's hard to recommend it because there's so many people who have such horror stories to tell. But with sane parents, I mean, the one thing they said was, you can work all you want, because I was way ahead of myself in school anyway, and I would just have been a troublemaker if I hadn't gotten to go out and work. So it was fine with them, but don't. The only thing they wouldn't let me do is be a regular on a series, which was very insightful of them, because I worked and I had all the fun, but I was not saddled with the responsibility of carrying a show and having 200 people in the crew going, the kid's killing us.
What'd you do with all the money that you made as a kid?
I built a hotel on the outskirts of Houston that is currently 65% vacant. No, it wasn't that much money, believe me. And it all went into a trust fund, and it's sort of what I lived on in my early 20s as I searched for the meaning of life.
Which you're still searching for, no doubt.
Which I'm still searching for, yeah. But no, I mean, it was a little cushion to, like, you know, help me through the early part of my post-college years.
I'm thinking back to your Saturday Night Live days, and it seems to me you're doing more political humor now than you were even then.
Only because the political humor I was doing then wasn't allowed to reach the home screen.
Oh.
My ratio of that has pretty much always been the same. It's just how much gets out. I learned from that experience to sort of try to concentrate my activities in places where there are fewer people who can say no.
Is there a connection between your political humor and the fact that you used to be a journalist and had aspired to be one when you were young?
I don't know. I think it has more to do with just what I find funny, you know. I think everybody sort of in the comedy business gravitates to doing the kind of stuff that that makes them laugh, hopefully. I would hope that that's how the business is run. Gee, maybe I've missed something. But it's the stuff that I find amusing. I like the fact that real life keeps serving up these great scenarios that all I have to do is do a little tweaking of, rather than have to, you know, make up whole imaginary hunks of stuff. So it's probably part laziness, too.
Well, I know that you've been watching the presidential campaign. Have you decided who you're going to vote for?
No, I have no idea. And if I did, I probably wouldn't say it on the radio.
Right, right. Would it be bad for you as a humorist to say that on the radio?
Yeah. I tend to avoid benefits and political, you know, occasions where I'm, you know, a lot of satirists will sort of become appendages to movements of one sort or another, and I don't like to do that. I don't like to be regarded as kept by any part of the spectrum. I reserve the right to make fun of whoever I think is funny.
That worrying about offending them and owing them a favor.
Yeah. I mean, Jesse Jackson is one of the great funny political characters on the scene, you know, whatever else he may be, whatever else you may think of what he does. It's just, you know, a guy who rhymes his way through political life is amusing to me. And I'll very often, especially working in public radio, you find that listeners will respond with some puzzlement when you start making fun of people on the left. And I like doing that as well.
Do people give you a hard time about that?
Not a hard time, but it's you raise more hackles than you'd expect by doing that, you know. And there are certain subjects that you know. I think these days, if you make fun of what I can generally refer to as women's subjects, you'll get into more trouble, or you'll get more reaction than you will if you make fun of George Bush, let's say.
I have to say, you know, since you left Saturday Night Live, I think you've just carved out a really interesting niche and have just kind of like created all these things. You've created this really interesting radio show and commentaries on NPR, Great Voices for The Simpsons, odd roles in lots of movies, Spinal Tap. It just seems like a very original career that you've created for yourself.
Well, thanks. I guess I have sort of had the thought that I was I wanted to make up my career as I went along rather than get stuck in things. I've been very careful, for example, not to get involved in like a television series where I have to do the same thing every week, because I just have a very low tolerance for boredom. If life gets boring, man, I'm out. So I've had to sort of devise a career that could keep at least me interested, if nobody else, you know.
Well, Harry, we're out of time. Good luck on your Spinal Tap tour.
Well, thanks very much, Terry. You got to come see us. I'll give you a backstage pass.
Hey, I can meet all the women with the big bottoms.
That's right. All I can say is wear something black, dear.
Do you have your clothes picked out for the tour?
No, they're all being designed now.
I should have known a designer, of course.
Yeah. Oh, sure. You can't ad-lib this stuff.
Right.
This is serious business.
Well, have fun and good luck on the tour.
Thank you.
The new Spinal Tap record will be released next month. Harry Shearer hosts a weekly program called Le Show, which is carried on many public radio stations. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, now that the Iowa caucuses are over, you're looking ahead to the New Hampshire primary?
We are. Linda Wertheimer, who's in New Hampshire, tells us that this is usually when New Hampshire primary voters really make up their minds about whom they'll vote for in the primary there. She tells us how the Republican and Democratic candidates seem to be shaping up, what they're showing in the polls. We'll also be hearing from reporter Andy Bowers about an issue that's become significant on the Democratic side, which is what the various candidates did in the way of military service and what they've said about their military service. Also today, a report on French farmers and the GATT, and as we continue our look at former Soviet republics, Turkmenistan.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many people mourned the end of a publishing era when Time Incorporated merged with Warner Communications in 1989. Henry Luce's publishing empire had been around for 67 years, and two of its magazines, Life and Time, were once the most influential magazines in America. The deal that brought Time and Warner together was described by one financial reporter as the greatest spectacle in the history of the takeover game. John Leonard's been reading about it in the new book, To the End of Time, The Seduction and Conquest of a Media Empire, by Richard Klerman. Here's John's review.
As far as it goes, Richard Klerman's account of how Time, Inc. and all its magazines happened to merge with the Hollywood Joy Boys at Warner Communications, with nothing lost save honor and lots of money, is an angry delight. The empire that Luce built looked up one morning in the go-go 80s to decide that people weren't reading anymore, at least not in the numbers they used to, and certainly not any of the new magazines dreamed up in the Time Inc. boardroom, like TV Cable Week. It never occurred to anybody in Rockefeller Center to publish smaller, better magazines. Seeking instead to diversify and synergize, they looked elsewhere in the entertainment industry for a way to get rich quick. According to Klerman, a 20-year veteran of the company who quit in 1975, almost every decision they made was a dumb one. when they could have invested in Ted Turner's CNN or teamed up with other such venerable news organizations as the New York Times, CBS, Gannett, or Knight Ridder, they chose instead to invite and then reject a takeover bid from Paramount, which cost them $14 billion. They then persuaded Steve Ross to let them buy Warner for more than it was worth, after which this man who seems never to have read a book and seldom have ever read Time magazine became their czar, paying himself a neat $79 million a year, more than the entire editorial budget for America's oldest news weekly, while writers and editors were gunned down on Sixth Avenue and in all the foreign bureaus. To understand how this could have happened, you must grasp the energizing principle, the jumping beans of go-go capitalism in the 80s. In order to buy what you can't afford, you go to the go-go banks and borrow the go-go money, and your collateral consists of the assets of the company you want to buy. It's all done with mirrors, like snorting a line of cocaine. This is the story Klerman tells, sometimes wickedly, sometimes mournfully. Mournfully because he misses what he calls time culture, an editorial integrity immune to the blandishments of advertising, disinterested information as a sacred trust. But there's another story he omits. The sad fact of the matter is that Steve Ross didn't invent the swimsuit issue of Sports Illustrated, nor did he kill off a good magazine, like Life, to make room for a bad one, like People. And long before Life died for People's sins, Time Inc.'s editors in New York were meddling with a copy of their correspondence from abroad to make the whole world look more like the inside of Henry Luce's head, as we know from dozens of memoirs, including those of Theodore H. White, one of the many great reporters who had to leave Luce to speak the truth. Wonderful writers like James Agee, Dwight MacDonald, and John Kenneth Galbraith had likewise to decamp. From the Great Depression through Vietnam, the arts coverage of the Newsweekly was nothing but smarty pants, as if Time had been invented in the first place as a sort of early warning radar system or alarm clock to alert middle-class America to the next outrage of the avant-garde. What happened in the go-go 80s, and not only at Time Inc., was that slick agitprop yielded to empty packaging.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Richard Klerman's To the End of Time, published by Simon & Schuster. Fresh Air was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Joan Tuohy, Sue Weinstein, and Dorothy Farabee. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Many Black Americans think of Africa as the motherland. That's one of the reasons Black American writer Eddie Harris was drawn to Africa. On the next Fresh Air, Harris tells us why the trip left him disillusioned with Africa and Afrocentrism. It's the subject of his memoir, Native Stranger. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.